Gary Trudeau, the iconic cartoonist who created Doonesbury and has been skewering our political lives for over four decades, has also worked in theater and television. In an event last night presented by Oblong Books and Music at the White Hart Inn in Salisbury, Connecticut, we spoke with Trudeau about his career, politics, and his new book, Huge, 30 Years of Doonesbury on Trump. So I began by asking him of what he made of this election season's presidential debates.
those certainly one would have wanted to react in real time. And Saturday Night Live, you know, I've kind of had to concede the field to the Daily Shows and the purveyors of comedy that can do it almost immediately. And the late night shows didn't used to do that. Johnny Carson or whoever would tell it, you know, a lame joke about right. one candidate and then another lame joke about the other. And, you know, it's on the one hand, on the other hand. And that's more properly characterized as humor, not satire. Satire usually has a point of view. Jon Stewart had a point of view. Stephen Colbert had a point of view. And they were reacting in real time. I really miss those two. But Saturday Night Live is also just been awesome this season. I don't know if you've seen any of those.
Absolutely.
With Alec Baldwin. But, you know, I kind of am sorry that I'm not in a position to sort of react more quickly. The dailies would, I had about a 10-day lead on, mm-hmm. you know, 10 to 7-day lead. The Sundays are done 4 to 5 weeks in advance. So I'm already writing about post-election stuff. And I obviously can't make the assumption, although I did last time. At the last election, I actually wrote that Obama had won, and a lot of newspapers were really uncomfortable with that, but turned out I was right.
Yes, yes. So it worries me a little bit that you haven't done that this time.
I think it's a lot harder for the client newspapers to, I mean, they do get a chance to see this Sunday, but they see it so far in advance that I've alienated enough of them simply by stopping the daily strip. By the way, we do run reruns.
Classic Doonesbury.
That's what we don't call them reruns, we call them classic.
That's
Doonesbury,
right.
Doonesbury classics. You know, that was, I'm astonished that as many papers run the old strips as we try to curate them so that they don't feel particularly topical. We, you know, anything that was, you know, really ephemeral that happened just at that moment, everybody's forgotten, tend not to run those strips. I have tried to, you know, make nice to the newspapers because I'm so grateful that, you know, they still run the dailies, and making their life hard, and this would fall into that category. They'd have to make a call, and then there would be either a hole in the paper or there'd be a substitute, and then the phones start ringing for them. So, you know, I don't want to create those sorts of headaches.
When did the first newspaper say, okay, we're going to put this guy on the editorial page?
I couldn't tell you that. I know that it started pretty early. Back in the 70s, you know, you have to be kind of young. I was 22 when the strip was first syndicated. And the cluelessness that comes with that, you don't, you know, cluelessness is often, it's confused with courage sometimes. And people thought, oh, look what he's doing on the comics page. Well, you know, I just didn't know any better. And they were selling the strip, my syndicate was selling the strip as kind of dispatches from the front lines, you know, that I was just out of college, and so I was on the cutting edge of the counterculture. And newspapers even then were worried about losing young readers. And so it was marketed as this, you know, the first strip about sex, drugs, rock and roll, and politics. And that caused some real problems. If you're in hundreds of newspapers, it's pretty presumptuous to say, oh yeah, I know what the community standards are in your, you know, and a lot of people, when my strip would get pulled out, called it censorship. I always called it editing. I mean, editors every day have to make decisions, many decisions, about things they don't put in the paper. They're trying to shape a product that's appropriate for their audience. So I would, you know, defend editors who would kick me out, sort of paradoxically, because there's a lot of different community standards across this broad nation. But because they were, each paper was a client, in effect, when the strip got knocked out, that invariably made news or made local news. Right. And so I would hear from the reporter at, you know, the New York Daily News or the Washington Post or, you know, even smaller papers, and they'd say, oh, we're doing a story on this. And it made me so self-conscious that I began thinking defensively about the strip. How am I going to defend this? How am I going to defend this? And it was a major distraction. So what I did around 1972 was simply step back from commenting at all. And I didn't do any interviews for a long time about the strip. I did for my theatrical projects, but I didn't talk about the strip for about 25 years. And that created a totally unanticipated sort of mystique about the strip and about me as being shy and...
Recluse.
Recluse. And I was none of those things. I mean, none of my friends, would call me that. But it did make my life much less complicated. And I could just focus on the work and didn't have the distraction of worrying about how I was going to defend it or, how it was going to land. And I was also in the unique position that most artists are not, which is that it defied the need for promotion. Comic strips, for years and years, just arrived on your doorstep. If you were a subscriber of newspapers, it was just there. And you either read it or you didn't read it. It didn't matter whether the artist showed up on The Tonight Show. So that's a pretty unusual situation for an artist of any description to be in, is it really didn't matter to my career. So I just stepped in. Also, my wife was a public figure, so one in a family is enough. So I just was the potted palm. She was the public face of the family.
You did a show that I thought was the most brilliant satire, and was this your first foray into television?
In television, yes. I took a sabbatical 12 years into the strip to work on Broadway and off Broadway, and I did two shows, but this was. The show you're talking about is Tanner 88.
It was Tanner 88.
HBO's first quasi-scripted show.
Right. And Robert Altman.
Robert Altman was the director. I received a call from their brand new head of programming, and she said, a wonderful woman named Bridget Potter, who went on to glory at NBC, and she said, we're thinking of running a fictional character for president. That was it. That was the whole pitch. She said, will you write it? And I said, since I was pretty busy, I had three kids and I had a daily strip, and I said, well, I'll do it if you get Robert Altman to direct it. And it was a short phone call. She said, okay, and hung up. And a couple days later, she called back and said, okay, he'll do it. And I said, you realize it's late November. I know it's not a real campaign, but there's no scripts, there's no outlines, there's no actors. And she said, oh, you guys will figure it out. So we started hiring actors before there were even roles. They were just some of Bob's repertoire. They were his favorite actors. Michael Murphy played Tanner. Yeah. And we were fitting them for costumes, and we didn't have a script yet. So I started writing frantically through the holidays, and we went to New Hampshire and shot the first hour, the pilot. In New Hampshire, and got it to HBO 2 hours before airtime.
They love that. Yeah,
they'd never seen it. They'd never seen a script. They didn't have a chance to lawyer it. They just put it on the air and hope for the best, and supported us for the all the way up to the convention. We did 10 more episodes. They never interfered. No writer in the history of television has had that much. I mean, it was just guerrilla television. We were just, and Bob would make up, he would, some days he'd use the script, some days he wouldn't. We did a follow-up called Tanner on Tanner, and one of our young actors was Cynthia Nixon, and played Tanner's daughter. And so I said, well, let's imagine what their lives are like 16 years later. We imagined that Cynthia's character, Alex Tanner, became a documentary filmmaker. And so she makes a film about her father's failed campaign. We were in New York shooting this. It was for Sundance. I had written this elaborate scene at Elaine's, which was this sort of fancy restaurant on the east side in New York. And I had 10 characters in it. And Bob's, he looked at the script and said, you want me to shoot this in one day? And I said, I know, I kind of got carried away. And he said, all right, well, we only have one day, so we have to do it. So, he was the Pied Piper. And they just kind of improv their way through the whole scene, and at the end, magically got to where you needed to be in the story by the end. So, but I was pretty depressed. I'd been sitting there all day looking at the monitor with my earphones on. I didn't hear a word I'd written. And I must have looked a little depressed, at, you know, sitting in the back of the room when it was all over. And Altman came over and he sat down next to me. He said, "Trudeau, do you know why you write?" And I said, "Not so clear to me today, Bob." And he said, "You write so that the actors know who they are." And what he meant by that was the actors all trusted him. And if I created a character with sufficient detail and with enough care and with specificity that the actor could, particularly the kind of actor that he hired, very good at improv, this would give them, you know, the guidelines for building on that character. So he could lead them anywhere and they would know how to behave. Well, the final scene of the movie, which in my opinion is the best scene, is a long speech that Cynthia gives. I wrote about half of it, and Cynthia improvised the rest of it. And I went to the opening, and a friend of mine came up to me and said, "Oh, I really enjoyed that. I said, especially that last scene with Cynthia." And I said, "Well, you know, Cynthia actually improvised that. But as brilliant an actress as she is, as innovative as she is, there's no way she could have done it had she not known who she was." this confused my friend immensely, but
yeah.
I just
sure.
But there's something to that. Now, when the roles were reversed, and I was not only writing but as actually producing the show, as with Alpha House for Amazon, I became known as the script Nazi. This time, I had total control, so the actors said what I wrote, and you know they seemed happy enough with that.
Would Tanner have come to us if it wasn't for Gary Hart? He seemed like a very Gary Hartish character.
I'm trying to think. When did Gary Hart?
84. Well, he ran.
But he ran in 88, right?
And yes. Then, and,
but when did he implode? When did that
came? 84. 84. 84 was ran with against Mondale in the primary.
Yeah. I can't say that it was. You know, Gary Hart was foremost in my mind. Actually, the character was a bit of a sort of fantasy, sort of wish fulfillment. It's, oh, a Democrat, and I can make him exactly the way I want to make him. And that turned out, you know, to make him a conventional liberal seemed like a great idea for about 5 minutes. And then I said, oh, man, this guy's really boring. You know,
Is there a conventional liberal?
Well, at that time, it was sort of an old school liberal, Mondale type, okay. type liberal. And I thought, this really isn't very interesting. So I'll have to do to him what I do to all my characters, which is make him stumble and fall terribly. And that it's his trying to get past, you know, what he his own brand and to become something a little bit more authentic became his challenge. So I don't think it would have been very interesting for either Bob or me to just run, oh, this will be just our dream candidate and he'll do everything right. And he turns out to do pretty much everything wrong. I mean, it's a doomed campaign. But that there was some both comedy and pathos to find in
that. And you had wonderful crossover with real life of what was happening at that moment during
yes,
the campaign.
Yes, this was something that really you hadn't seen before, which was using real politicians, real people in media and in politics, in cameos. And what we quickly learned about that was I had seen people like Tip O'Neill appear on Cheers, and I'd seen politicians appear on sitcoms, and it always seemed forced and wooden, and they're not actors. They're gifted in their realms, but they're not actors. And so what I decided to do was to take the scenes that had them and create a situation for them to behave in, but not write any dialogue for them. And so we had, for instance, we had Kitty Dukakis. We shot her the day of the convention, so they were riding pretty high, and we actually went into their hotel room. And one of my characters, Tanner's girlfriend, he has a girlfriend that's become scandalous, and the girlfriend is working on his campaign, so she resigns. And she used to work for Dukakis. That's the backstory. So we explain all this to Kitty, and they said, just react the way you would react. It doesn't matter. We're not going to give you any lines. You can't say anything wrong. And the actress she was playing against was very gifted, and she just took it and ran with it. And that always worked very well for us. is simply give them something to talk about that they felt something to about or they were passionate about. Bruce Babbitt, who was a candidate then, mm-hmm. he had just dropped out. And so we had Tanner walk around the reflecting pool with him and said, just talk about what you learned, you know, from your experience. And all this wonderful stuff just came tumbling out of him. So with Alpha House, we did pretty much the same thing as we didn't give them too many lines. The person that we gave lines to was Elizabeth Warren, and she just nailed it. She was... And I have to say, I mean, I don't think we've by any means heard the last of Elizabeth Warren because she was a rock star. When she visited our set, we shot in Queens, and there are all these kind of working class crew members who were there, and they just flocked around her for selfies like no other politician I've ever seen. I mean, she was just charismatic. She's quite tall, and she wears these outfits that are... you know, bright red, and she walks into a room, and it's just, wow. And the cast loved her, and John Goodman, who doesn't get nervous very easily, he was shaking like a leaf. He had to do a scene with Elizabeth Warren, and it worked out great.
So you see your future more in television than...
Well, I think it sort of, it's surprising... similar to what I had been doing. What I had been doing was great training for writing for television, to develop characters, story arcs, you braid them together, you create this thicket of coincidence and you throw them all in. All these kinds of things where, you know, a comic strip creator is master of his own domain. He's creating the lighting, the scenery, the everything. And that's how I started my creative life as a child growing up in Saranac Lake. When I was seven, I started a little theater group. And I ran it for 10 years, just the neighborhood kids. And I did everything. I did the lighting, wrote the scripts and the music and the scenery and all that. The one thing I didn't want to do, I thought was much too hard, was to act. I just wanted to be the impresario. I just wanted to move all the pieces around. And so this is a kind of, you know, doubling back. It's a full circle. It's a complete circle. It's what my dream was as a kid. So I love doing it.
Gary Trudeau's new book is huge, 30 Years of Doonesbury on Trump. He'll be our guest on next week's book show, airing Tuesday at 3, Thursday at 8:30. His most recent series, Alpha House, also available on Amazon Prime. Our interview was recorded last night at an event presented by Oblong Books and Music at the White Hart Inn in Salisbury, Connecticut. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.